Thank you, Russ Stewart. Good morning to your friends. Another beautiful day. Honest it is. If you'll remember your history, you'll recall that nearly 300 years passed after the birth of Christ before the anniversary of his birth was celebrated. And by that time, nobody could recall for sure exactly when his birthday was. Well, naturally, there were no established systems of birth certificates, no departments of vital statistics back in those days. And when there came the desire to celebrate Christmas, nobody knew, well, really, what was the correct date. There were, however, many different people who thought they knew, but each had a different date in mind. And there followed then nearly 200 years of controversy and bickering and debate, and gradually it settled into two major schools of thought. Some folks thought Christmas should be celebrated December 25th, others thought it should be the 6th of January. And ultimately, as you could maybe guess, the date of December 25th won out. Well, the chief thing that recommended it, it seems, was the fact that in ancient pagan times, December 25th had been a holiday set aside to worship the sun god Mithra. And as long as that date had already been established as a holiday, it seemed kind of efficient to keep on with it instead of picking out some brand new date. No need to change the red ink on the calendar, you know. Same old holiday, just new significance. Well, the important thing, of course, is the fact that that date finally was decided upon. We can all celebrate Christmas together. But now, so help me, I'm coming to suspect that there should be one more date decided upon, so far as the Yuletide observation is concerned. The only reason I hesitate to suggest it is because I hate to start another controversy that might rage for another 200 years. Except for that one thing, I think we should have a definite date for the start of the holiday. For it's perfectly obvious that Christmas is no longer a day, it's a season. December 25th is merely the climax of a story that starts back before Thanksgiving and splashes over to the far side of New Year's. I think it was a good 3 weeks ago that I first heard White Christmas on the radio. At first, I was going to keep track of how many times I heard it, but I ran out of fingers when Thanksgiving was still a few days off. A freelance artist apparently covered the neighborhood near KFI this past weekend, painting Christmas scenes and snowdrops on various store windows. Something like the stories our first grade teacher used to tell us about Jack Frost sneaking in with his paintbrushes and everyone's back was turned. Now, out our way, some eager beaver already has his outdoor Christmas tree lights in place, giving the offhand impression that some chicken dinner place has disregarded zoning ordinances. The only sad thing about it, as I see it, is the fact that it gets to be kind of anticlimactic before December 25th ever gets here. All the records in the jukebox containing Christmas carols are old and scratchy, and the street decorations are wind-blown and dismal. In the department store, Santa's whiskers have lost their first blush of snowy whiteness and commenced to take on the appearance of bleached hemp that's trying to curl back into a hunk of rope. Morning dew and midday smog have taken their toll of Christmas scenes painted on store windows. Each snowdrop has a drooping tail like a comet. And the snow scenes look muddy and the reindeer appear to be molting. And by Christmas Eve, when the street carolers swing down your street, you're more apt to brace yourself and sputter, "If I hear White Christmas once more, I'll scream." I honestly believe it would be kind of fun if we had an officially appointed date for the start of the Christmas season. Nobody allowed to put up Christmas decorations or sing Christmas songs until, December 23rd. That way it would still be new and fresh and exciting by the time Christmas Day arrived. Oh, I realize, of course, that a lot of us probably wouldn't get around to doing any Christmas shopping until the last minute either. Maybe 40% of us would get killed in the rush, but I still think it'd be exciting fun for the fortunate 60% that survived. So I herewith offer it in the form of a motion. Now leave us take 200 years to debate it, huh? From one of our good notebook listeners comes a recipe for Hossenpfeffer. I love that word. You use yummy yogurt. I won't read all the recipe, but I reckon you know that Hossenpfeffer is rabbit prepared most deliciously in a vinegar solution first, then ending up in golden cream gravy. And here is where the yummy yogurt comes in. If anybody would like a copy of Mrs. Metz's Hossenpfeffer, just drop me a line. Never mind, I can't spell it either. This is not one of the yummy recipes that I've been raving about you get in the folder. It's a privately owned affair. But you will find some wonderful dishes in the yummy yogurt recipes. There's beef stroganoff, for instance. It's scrumptious. Liver in yummy yogurt sauce. That's another. Borscht. You can make it with yummy yogurt. Easy, different, delicious recipes, these are. They can perk up any budget program. I'd like you to write for your free copy. I don't think you'd duplicate what I'm sending you here in any of your collection. And if you want to, just mention the Hossenpfeffer one, too. Draw pictures of a hoss if you want. I'll know what you want. Yummy yogurt is handled by all better food stores. It's home delivered, too. Place your order for regular deliveries with Pellasir or Golden State or Crown City Dairy. I'm talking about YAMI, yummy, YOGURT, yogurt. Right about now, you will find one of the most popular items of apparel in these parts is neither mink nor ermine nor even ostrich plumes. It's a little red feather, symbolic of a contribution to the community chest. And since the story of the community chest is so well known and the moral is so obvious, leave us take a moment here to consider the feather itself instead of the great cause that it symbolizes. Now, you may or may not be interested to know that the feather comes from an ordinary barnyard fowl, a white leghorn, no doubt, and has been dyed that brilliant red. Now, while this news may not send your heart leaping with joy, still, the members of the Audubon Society and other bird lovers consider that very important. For it was back in 1939 that the red feather first appeared in connection with a community chest drive. Only back there, it was a feather that was naturally red. It was not dyed. And it was plucked from a special, brightly colored tropical bird. And while the volunteer workers were rejoicing at the way the idea was catching on, there were poor little strangely denuded tropical birds shivering with the cold, if you can shiver in the tropics. They had been relieved of their brilliant red plumage for a very good cause, no doubt. But there are few sights in this world more pitiful than a bird that has suddenly and involuntarily become a nudist. And so vigorous were the protests from bird lovers that ever since, the little red feathers have come from the hen coop at molting time and artificial coloring applied. But of course, it's the symbolism that's the important thing. What it stands for is more important than where it came out of. Well, the significance of the feather in the hat traces its way far back through literature and through history, and the American Indians use it even without a hat. The privilege of wearing the feathers was generally reserved for men who had demonstrated achievement in fighting the common enemy. Among the ancient Lycians, no man was permitted to wear a feather unless he had slain a Turk on the field of battle. And the man who had killed two Turks was permitted to wear two feathers and so on. And since they didn't have guns upon which to notch the handle, the wearing of feathers served somewhat the same general purpose. And a medieval Sergeant York might sprout so many feathers he'd have a tough time staying grounded in a high wind. Among certain of the American Indians, the privilege of wearing feathers was allotted on about the same basis to men who had met and conquered the enemy on the battlefield. Well, that's about how it is today. As we face the common enemies of hunger and cold, deprivation and pestilence. And those who have shown valor in combating these enemies through contributions to the community chest are privileged to wear the red feather. And the significance has not changed so very much after all, has it? There's perhaps many an ermine cape that has failed to capture so many glances of honest respect and admiration as the little red feather of the community chest, worn so proudly by those who are privileged to wear it. Have you made a practice of wearing yours? Put it on. The month of December is by far the greatest spending period of the year. Money is on the move. And to me, it seems a rather good time to think about saving. I don't mean that we're not going to have Christmas or give presents and be glad, but I do mean that we might consider the means by which we do it. We earn money, and if we're wise, we save part of all we earn. And it's these savings that in turn should be working for us. And if you are not getting the maximum return on any savings accounts, do this, will you? Check with California Federal Savings and find out, you'll want to know their past record. I was amazed to find that some people don't even know what rate of return they are getting on their money. Others let a checking account build up to a point that's beyond efficiency. And this money is doing you no good, just lying idle. I know you enjoy a checking account, but you, everyone, knows just about the right amount that he should keep in it. The balance, I think, should go into savings. Now call personally if you can, or telephone, or write. California Federal Savings and Loan, 5680 Wilshire Boulevard, corner of Massillon, that is, in the heart of the Miracle Mile. Now you can open an account by mail or by phone. For mail, the zone is 36. Put that money to work for you at California Federal, and now would be a very good time. I imagine you could pick out almost any street corner in town and climb up on a soapbox and loudly proclaim, "The most valuable thing in all the world is a true friend." There'd probably be nary a soul step up to argue the point with you. You could do a pretty fair job of lining your house with little framed mottos about the value of friendship. And while there might be folks who would question your taste in decorating, you'd find few who would debate your premise. Yeah, there's hardly a man who's worth his salt who hasn't left the world some worthwhile quotation on the value of friendship. Bartlett's Quotations uses up a good five columns of its index, just listing the various things you could say about a friend or about friendship if you cared to do so. But for all that, I wonder if the idea has ever really gotten across to the vast majority of us. Money, the love of it is the root of all evil, of strife and upheaval. We'll sneer at it, condemn it, insist that it doesn't bring happiness. But just the same, we'll work like dogs to get our fingers on a little of it. Fame? Bah, humbug. False idol is fickle, is treacherous, a thing to be shunned. But where's the guy who wouldn't diligently read through a list of 500 names in his newspaper just to find his name among the bunch and then get a little glow when he finds it, huh? Friends? Ah, yes, friends are different. The most valuable things in the world. You can measure a man's true wealth by the friends he has, but how often are we willing to put ourselves out, even a smidgen, in order to acquire friends? I got to thinking about that the other evening in a mixed group, when a gentleman I know slightly commenced waxing philosophical between hiccups. "I tell you, old pal, friends are the best thing in the world. I don't care what I got so long as I got friends." You perhaps know the type. And when he wasn't talking about friends, old pal, he was talking about a hunting trip that he'd been on recently, with gestures yet. He would crouch beside the davenport to show how he had hidden in the duck blinds. He'd raise his arms and squint to show how he'd aimed. Then you could see him pull the trigger, and he went bang, bang. And right quick-like, one hand would dart up to illustrate how the dead duck had fallen into the marsh. I think it was relief to everybody he didn't insist upon a journey to the bathroom where he could fill up the tub and illustrate how he'd waded out after his birds. Now, I think almost anybody would tell you without hesitation that a good friend is much more valuable than a dead duck. But where is the man who would go to so much trouble to acquire a new friend? Without any thought of martyrdom for a duck, he will crawl out of bed at 2 a.m., start for the wide open spaces. He'll drive hundreds of miles, spend a great many dollars. He'll crouch for 3 days in a duck blind till he can barely stand up and his legs ache with the misery. He'll wade through water. He'll come home at last, tired but happy, lugging two dead ducks that taste strangely like herring and are peppered full of bird shot and a hazard to teeth. Was it worth it? Silly question. Of course it was worth it. Gee whiz, he got two ducks, didn't he? What do you mean, was it worth it? But where is the man who would crawl out of bed at 2 a.m. to garner a new friend? Ah, nuts, I'll settle for just the friends I can make in the daytime without crawling out of bed in the middle of the night. He will sit patiently and gladly in a duck blind for 3 days, think nothing of it, but after he spent a little time on a street corner waiting for a friend, he takes on an air of martyrdom. "I don't mind being a good friend and all that, but this is ridiculous. 10 minutes I've been waiting here, and he hasn't showed up yet." It makes you wonder what could be achieved if we ever honestly sold ourselves on the idea that friends are the most wonderful things in the world. And if we would do as much to gain friends as we do to acquire money or to bag a couple of ducks.